Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Circular Sessions is a video series showcasing the breadth and depth of the Midwestern music scene through interviews and performances. I'll talk with collaborators Sam Fatala and Shyla Kay. That's coming up in about 40 minutes. But first, Jackson Pollock's mural is the most famous work of art owned by the University of Iowa. And in recent years, it's been through a lot. Mural was saved from the floods of 2008 and spent quite a bit of time at the Figge Museum in Davenport. It was sent to the Getty Museum in Los Angeles to be restored, and it's now on tour. It's been around the world, and it's traveling around the country right now. It will return to the University of Iowa when the new University of Iowa Museum of Art is ready for it. We don't have a date for that yet. This iconic work of art has inspired a book, it's inspired an award-winning documentary, and now Steinway pianist and composer, educator, and author Dan Knight is writing a piano concerto inspired by this work. And Dan Knight is on the line with me now. Hello, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Charity. How are you?
Wonderful. It's so great to hear your voice. Thank you for being
here. Oh, it's so great to hear your voice. This is, it's been way too long.
Yes, it has. And we also have Joni Kinsey with us, professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. Joni, thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And before we dig into Dan's relationship with Mural and the work that he's doing, I want to get a little art history education. First, tell us about this work of art. Jackson Pollock created Mural. Tell me about it.
Well, first of all, for those who have never seen it, it's an enormous painting, nearly 20 feet wide and a little over 8 feet tall. So imagine an entire long wall. It's an abstract painting with lots and lots of very vigorous, large brush strokes that move up and down and across the painting. Not a lot of color in terms of great range, but vivid color and blues and pinks and whites and greens, blacks that swirl throughout the scene. It's not a landscape. It has a certain flatness to it. You don't enter it in depth, but at the same time, there's a magical kind of rhythmic, energetic quality to it. So with that, the painting itself is widely regarded as perhaps Jackson Pollock's most important painting. Certainly it's his largest ever produced. It is hailed by art people across the world as being really his transition work from his early style to his mature style, but it also essentially opened the door for abstract painting in the second half of the 20th century. It's considered a really pioneering, fundamental work of art to the history of modern art.
And for Pollock himself, it marked a kind of a change. This was the last painting that he did standing up, right? He changed his method after
exactly.
That.
His mature style is known for its the drip paintings in which he laid the canvas on the floor and moved energetically across the painting, literally walking on it sometimes, flinging paint and dripping paint. He was sometimes called Jack the Dripper. But this painting, our mural, was a move towards that in that it does have some splatter techniques, but it was painted vertically on an upright wall. And he literally kind of danced and moved across the scene with his arms really gesturing wildly as he put the paint on the canvas.
And what did he say about this work of art? What did he say it meant?
He certainly regarded it as one of his most important. One quote that I found particularly interesting, because we don't tend to think of it as a figurative painting, a representational work of art with images that we can recognize, but he told a friend years later that it was something out of a vision. And here's the quote. He said, "It was a stampede of every animal in the American West, cows and horses and antelopes and buffaloes. Everything is charging across that
Well, remove an expletive.
Expletive surface, which is a fascinating statement because it evokes American landscape and the energy of animals. He was from Wyoming, although he was born in Iowa, and the open spaces and the energy of that space and its inhabitants was really fundamental to his whole life. But we don't think of that in this picture, but I think it's interesting to do so. Yeah.
So how did it come to the University of Iowa?
Well, that's a fascinating story for us here and for the world of art more generally. He received a commission from Peggy Guggenheim, who was a very significant art dealer and patron in New York City. She gave him his first one-man show in 1943, and she invited him to paint this for her townhouse in New York City, the long entry hallway. Everyone in the New York art world came to this house and would see it, and it was kind of in conjunction with the exhibition. Interestingly, there's a lot of wonderful connections for those who know about significant people in the art world. Marcel Duchamp actually had a role in this painting, suggesting that it'd be painted not on the wall itself, but on canvas so it could be portable. And he was given free rein. He moved out of what had been already an increasingly abstract style, but it still had some recognizable forms. And here we have really ultimately an abstract work with no recognizable forms. But the commission, it was installed in her house. It was a sensation for many people there. But by 1947, Peggy Guggenheim was moving to Venice. She was selling her gallery and all of its contents or giving some of it away. And she knew of a remarkable collection, and not really so much collection, but program here at the University of Iowa under the direction of Lester Longman in the Department of Art at the university. And he had been doing a lot of very, very ambitious and avant-garde exhibitions, which took a lot of Iowans by surprise. And she wanted to support that program. So she offered not only this painting, but several other smaller ones, one by Pollock and several others by notable mid-century modernists, to the university in exchange for simply the postage. She shipped it to us COD, cash on delivery. And Longman was interested, and yes, it was sent, and it sat at the loading dock here in Iowa City at the post office waiting for the postage to be paid, which took a while. But it was a remarkable gift in a period in which very few people really knew who Jackson Pollock was. It didn't come here till 1951. He already was making a name for himself nationally by that point. And so there was some interest in him as a notable artist. Life magazine, for example, in August of 1947, had a major article about him. And the headline was, "Jackson Pollock, is he the greatest living painter in the United States?" And there he is standing in front of not our mural, but a big splashy painting that looks very similar. So it entered the university before we ever even had a museum. It was hung in the art department in the mural painting studio for many years with students painting around it. And it then went to the university library and hung there for quite some time. And then finally we got a museum, and it was the centerpiece of the displays at the University of Iowa Museum before the flood.
All right. And then, of course, the flood came, and we could have lost this work of art. I mean, so much was lost in that flood, and it was rescued from the floodwaters, spent time in Davenport. And I want to kind of fast forward to this restoration work. And I would refer you to another Talk of Iowa where we talked about that in depth, about the kind of work that was done and the veneer that was on it and all of these things. But we sent it off to the Getty Museum in Los Angeles to have it restored. And I mean, they did an incredible amount of work on this.
It was a multi-team research project for the Getty. They were fascinated by the challenges of dealing with a painting this large and with some of the issues that it had. There's a wonderful film about it if people are interested in seeing it. It's on the web. It was shown on Iowa Public Television, and you can watch it on their website. It's called Mural, the Story of a Modern Masterpiece. It's about an hour long, and it goes into great detail about the history of the painting, but also the history of this conservation project. There's also a short version on YouTube, which is about 7 minutes, if people want to get a brief glimpse into it, and you can certainly see a great view of the painting itself.
And of course, so many people walked past it at the Getty. It came back to Iowa briefly and to Sioux City and then to Europe. And now it's back in the United States, right?
It just finished a run all last fall at the National Gallery of Art. It's now in, I believe, South Carolina, going soon to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's been seen by millions and millions of people around the world.
And it will come back to the University of Iowa when we have a museum again.
When we finally have a museum again, and we are anxiously raising money so that we can make that happen.
Right. So we don't have a date.
No,
for
not
that.
Yet. They have a plan. They have architectural. It's ready to break ground. They just need to raise some more money.
All right. So, Dan, you yourself, you have a long history with this work of art because, of course, we know that you are an Iowa native and spent a lot of time in Iowa City. When did you first encounter Mural?
First, let me say that synopsis was brilliant. Absolutely. Just like it beautiful. Beautiful account of the history of the piece and the piece itself, and that was masterfully done. My first experience with Mural personally in person was in 1977 when I came to the University of Iowa as a transfer student, and the University of Iowa Museum of Art was always one of those places we drove by on the way to Hancher Auditorium. And I can never talk anybody who was with me to going to the art museum while we were actually going to hear somebody perform at Hancher. So finally, when I moved to Iowa City in 1977, one of the first things I did was haul myself down to the Museum of Art. And, of course, I went to the Elliott Gallery and saw these masterful pieces there. Some of the greatest people in 20th century art were represented there. But then I walked through the hallway and went down around the corner and back to the back part of the building that was open, and there was Mural, and it stopped me. The energy of the piece stopped me about 50 feet away from it. I couldn't get any closer to it, so I had to stand there and look at it. And it was the first time, literally the first time, that a piece of art had made me deal with it on its own terms.
Fascinating. Well, Dan, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about Jackson Pollock's Mural, and Dan Knight, pianist and composer, is working on a piano concerto inspired by Mural. Also with me today, Joni Kinsey, professor of American art history at the University of Iowa, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Jackson Pollock's Mural, which is the most famous work of art owned by the University of Iowa. It is not at the University of Iowa right now. It's touring the country at the moment and will return to the University of Iowa when the new art museum is built and ready for it. But this iconic work of art, it's inspired many, many people over the years. It's inspired a book, an award-winning documentary, and now Steinway pianist and composer, educator, and author Dan Knight is writing a piano concerto inspired by the work. With me, of course, is Dan Knight and Joni Kinsey, professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. And Dan, just before the break, we were talking about when you first encountered Mural back in the 1970s and how it just stopped you in your tracks. So tell me a little bit about how you reacted to that and then came back to this work of art.
Well, it's just stunning. And it's even more stunning after having gone through the renovation at the Getty, because the focus of Mural is even more directed and it's sharper. The image is sharper. They fixed some issues that it had with the actual mounting of the piece itself. So anyway, it's almost parabolic, and the energy that leaps off the wall is just astounding. So basically, it stopped me. It stopped me about 40 feet away from it. I stood and looked at it, and then I got a little closer, and And then a little closer, and there's no real point in the piece where you actually are directed to look. So you have to deal with the whole piece in its entirety, and then it draws you as you start to view it. It draws you into the different aspects of it that are interesting: color, sound, rhythm, movement. It's all there just in one piece, and you really truly just have to deal with it on its own terms.
Well, and you said sound and rhythm, and of course not all of us think like a musician, Dan. Not all of us would hear this work of art. I'm curious, when did you first start thinking about it musically?
Well, I started thinking about it musically right away because I could hear music when I saw it. So I sat and I actually spent about an hour with the piece because it was kind of interesting to me because I could hear rhythm, I could hear melodies and fragments of melodies, and it was kind of like listening to the old days of radio when you're going around in a car, say across the country at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you had a faint hint of a radio station off in the distance. So you got a little bit of it, but not quite all of it right away. That's kind of how it was for me, just kind of tuning in and trying to listen to it and find where it was. But it was really interesting for me because that first day I sat there for like an hour, and they had a couple of really, really, really nice leather chairs in the Museum of Art. So I just sat in one of the leather chairs and kind of hung out for a while. And then I watched other people have the experience with the piece. And they had the same thing happen. People would walk in and it would stop them about 35, 40 feet out. And they would figure out how to kind of come into its presence. And that's really kind of the only way I know how to describe it. But so I started making notes on the piece right away. And that kind of composition was something I had only started doing back in 1977. So I would come back to it and visit it again and again and again and again. And as my compositional skills increased and my listening skills increased as well. Over a couple of decades, I guess.
Wow.
It was one of those things that just never left me. And when Pam Trimpe and I started working together back in the late 90s and early 2000 or so, I was doing some concerts at the university. Well, I went doing quite a few of them and doing some fundraisers and that kind of thing. So we actually did... I came up with the idea for doing a collection of new works based on the works in the Elliott Gallery, and we called that Recording Pictures at an Exhibition. So I stole the idea from Mussorgsky, who actually wrote pieces of music based on the Art of the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. So I said to Pam, I said, Pam, why don't we do that here? Why don't maybe I put together a suite of pieces or of original pieces of music based on things in the Elliott Gallery? And she thought that was great. So she wrote a nice little book to insert to accompany the recording, and then we did the recording in the mid, probably 1997.
So really, you've been spending 40 years building up to this piano concerto.
Yeah,
is what you're
yeah,
telling
cause,
me.
Yeah, because at that time, I said to Pam, I said, really, what we should be doing is somebody should be doing a major piece of music based on Jackson, on Mural. that's the elephant in the room. This is the big one. I mean, and we have it. It's here. And she and I talked about it at that time, maybe what kind of shape that would take. So it wasn't until a few years ago that the idea just kind of hadn't really kind of left me. And I mentioned the whole process to René Lecuona, who is a fantastic pianist at the University of Iowa in the School of Music. And she is just absolutely fearless. She was playing the Brahms violin concerto with my great friend Leopold Lafosse, and we had actually had an opportunity to visit. And I said, Rene, would you be interested in doing a piece that I could write for you. And she was really interested. And then I said, well, how about maybe something based on Jackson Pollock's mural? And she flipped out. So that's how the thing really kind of got traction, a reality.
And you did something really unusual. The University of Iowa did something unusual with this piece. Actually crowdfunded your composition through the University of Iowa Gold Rush campaign and raised $20,000 to invest in this project. Is that what is making it possible for you to make this a reality?
Oh, it really is. In so many ways, you know. At first, it's kind of one of those things where I don't have an impresario, so there's nobody there who is just kind of saying, "Okay, Dan, just go ahead and do what you want to do. We don't really care if it makes any money or not. You know, just go ahead and go to work and follow your creative instincts." And for those people who have that, I say God bless them. But you know, my impresarios have been like hundreds of friends who have supported me and through thick and thin, mostly thin. And Charity, you're one right at the top of the list. So this thing kind of came about because folks at the university thought it was a great idea, and I'm happy for the fact that it's crowdsourced. A, because it means that from people all over the state kind of get to own this too, but since it's not a work for hire, since the university didn't pay me to do it, then it means that I get to keep the rights to the piece.
Nice.
So the university is going to have the right to use it and perform it in perpetuity, but I get to retain ownership of my work, which is wonderful.
Now, with the work restored and with this project underway, you've also been spending quite a bit of time with Mural again recently. Last summer, when it was at the National Gallery of Art, you went to visit Mural there. So now seeing it in its restored glory, how is it different to you?
Oh, it's you know, the only way I know how to describe it, and for those of us who are of a certain age, I think maybe we'll understand, I just had cataract surgery on my left eye a few months ago, and it's amazing the difference in the way I see color now in the eye that's had the cataract surgery, basically because the cataract is a little bit jaundiced, and so anyway, the colors are brighter, the focus is far more intense. It has more energy. I mean, it literally vibrates more if that's possible. It has more focus, and they fixed the hanger in the back. They fixed the framework upon which the painting hangs, and kind of tucked it in a little bit so that there were a couple of gaps in the bottom where you could actually see some spaces that weren't painted. They were not meant to be seen, so the folks at the Getty did a beautiful job of restoration. But basically what happened is that they pulled it. Another analogy would be like the Hubble telescope before the fix. And
there really is
a universe in that painting. It really is there, and the energy and vitality of it is unique to it. So it's just astounding. So it was astounding when I saw it in 1977, and that was shortly after the renovation that happened in 1974. So this is just beyond words. It is most amazing.
So tell me about your process now that you're listening to this work of art and putting it down on paper and playing Mural. How does that work for you? How do you make that transfer?
Well, the first thing that happens is that there are a whole list of things that the piano concerto inspired by Mural can't be. You know, number one, it can't be a piano concerto in the frame. So it can't be this kind of the standard piano concerto of A movement followed by B movement followed by C movement, just because the piece doesn't give itself up that way. So anything that's based on on melody and structural pattern and the rhythm, say even something like Gershwin, just won't work for this piece. If you kind of take the music and play it for the piece of art, if you present it to it, the piece of art just kind of rejects it literally. So what my process has been is to go back to the notes that I made from 1977 and some of the things from 1980, and I structured the piano concerto this way. The first movement will be about the contemplation of the preparation of the piece. So the evocative image for me is that photograph, that beautiful photograph, black and white, of Jackson Pollock standing in front of a naked canvas that he has just prepared. He's getting ready to start his work. And I thought, what is the mental aspect of that? You know, the man is standing there looking at this thing, and it's enormous. It's 24 feet long. And part of him has to be going, oh, my God, what am I going to fill that space with? And that's what the first movement's going to be about, that emotional response to the work ahead of him. And that's something that I don't know that I've seen in a piano concerto before.
Yeah.
So it's going to be unique to this piece. And then the second movement's going to be the actual creating of the piece itself. So when people come to listen to this piano concerto, what they're actually going to hear is an oral version of the creation of the piece. So every time they come to listen to the piano concerto, they'll get to hear mural being created, and so that will relate to the colors of yellow and those really vibrant pinks that he threw on the canvas. So there'll be splashes of that, this brilliant, brilliant, brilliant yellow enamel that he used, and there's house paint in the thing, and so what I'm going to do is use the orchestra to create these different textures with the piano, and then the third movement will be hopefully a symphonic depiction of the actual piece itself. So we'll incorporate all the aspects of the painting and some of the aspects of his thought prior to the painting itself, and then the third movement will be just that. So
bringing all of those pieces
bringing
together.
All of it together.
And,
yes, exactly.
Let's talk more about these colors. You were just talking about the color yellow, this very vibrant yellow. And
yes.
So when you focus on a color, mm-hmm. and you hear that color, how do you translate that into music? Because we're going to listen to a little bit of yellow here. So tell us how we got to what we're going to listen to.
Well, how I got to listen to it, it's, I sat down and looked at the piece, especially, and this came from my last view when I went to the National Gallery of Art in D.C. I spent 3 days sitting in front of the piece. So I just kind of asked it. I said, what does yellow sound like? And I looked at it and got rid of my preconceptions about maybe what the sound of the color yellow might be. And this is what happened. So I heard it in the flutes immediately. And then I thought to myself, what would it sound like if I explored this color yellow and moved it to different instruments? So most of them were woodwinds. So I decided this is how I worked through the whole process. So I heard the color yellow, and then I decided to do a study in the color yellow so I could kind of manipulate it around a little bit and see how maybe it would work, and then figure out from that how I might be able to use it in mural. So
all right, and we have a little bit of music from your composition software. Let's listen to some yellow. Okay. All right, so that's just a tiny taste of yellow. And in just about a minute, we'll go out with a little red, but we only have about a minute left, Dan. So this work is in progress right now, and you're planning to debut it when that museum opens, right?
Right, and the piece itself will be done, and we'll have the score done and the bound copies already in 6 months. We'll have it done by probably middle of August.
Oh, and then we have to wait for the museum to be able to hear it? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's terrible. So get that museum, please, you know. Bring this poor painting and this poor boy home with it, you know. So if Muriel finds a home, maybe I can come back to Iowa too, please.
So. All right. Well, Dan, we can't wait to hear what you've come up with. And thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you. I miss you every day. Keep on keeping on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Knight, pianist and composer, educator and author. He's in North Carolina now. And Joni Kinsey, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Glad to do it.
Joni Kinsey, professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. Dan is working on a piano concerto inspired by Jackson Pollock's mural. And we're going to go out here with a little bit of red. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.